Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
9:07 now. Courtney, is that Coke truck cleared up? Tim tells me off of Clearview, so that, thank goodness I got that cleared up. We're good to go. Thank you. We are going to go into the 9 o'clock hour here and talk to Zach Lehman, a curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. Talk about the snow and what effect it may have or may not have had on the insect population. How you doing, Zach?
I'm good. How are you?
How does one become curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium?
Well, I guess if you're like most kids, you enjoy bugs, mm-hmm. and I never grew up, so I stuck with the bugs.
Good for you.
I have to ask you to pause for just 1 second. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm back.
You sure?
My timing wasn't good there, but I'm good now. And
you didn't have a roach crawling on you.
In cold weather too.
You didn't have a roach crawling on you or anything, did you?
No, I was parking, and they're doing construction at work, and the security person didn't know I was on the phone with you, so she was trying to tell me something, and I said, I can't do that. Well, I got important bug stuff to talk about.
You mentioned the name Tommy Tucker. That'll get you anywhere you need to be, my friend. I'll tell you. Matter of fact, I'm the causeway from henceforth will cross the Lake Tucker. I made that change myself too, but we'll announce.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about.
Wow, you got. I was going to say, you've got a lot of influence there.
It's just a self-imposed thing now. We'll see what Google Maps thinks about it later. Let's talk about the insects and the cold. Did all of that snow kill off? Here's my best possible case. With all the inconvenience we had, Zach, it killed all the termites, all the roaches, and we don't have to worry about anything, and all the mosquitoes, too, so we don't have to worry about anything. It's going to be a beautiful spring. Am I right?
I hope it'll be a beautiful spring. Mm. I do not think we are going to see a whole lot of reduction in pest numbers because of this weather. And I know that's not what a lot of people want to hear, mm-hmm. but the fact of the matter is that we are subtropical, which means that periodically, if you live here, you know this, we get a freeze, usually a light freeze, sometimes a hard freeze that may last a day or two. And because that's been the case for thousands upon thousands of years here, insects that are native to this area are adapted for it. Now, that's not to say that some of our introduced species that are tropical, that cannot get out of the cold weather, might not have died. But subterranean things like termites and ants that are going to be under soil or in wood are very well insulated from that cold, cold air and the wind associated with it. Things like mosquitoes, they will literally be motionless, sometimes even on the ground, and appear dead in cold weather. Insects are ectothermic. They do not create their own heat in their bodies like we mammals and birds do. So they can't be active when it's cold. But I will tell you, Tommy, that I was in a marsh in South Louisiana on Saturday morning, mm-hmm. and I was assaulted by mosquitoes. Mm. So did you call anybody? No, I was out in the middle of the marsh enjoying nature,
cold weather with the snow and everything else, there were still mosquitoes around.
That's my point. Yes, and you would find that most insects that have an egg stage or a pupa stage, if they live in a place where there is some significant cold winter weather, they'll pass through the winter as an egg or a pupa because that stage of life isn't actively trying to eat and grow like the larva or actively trying to find a mate and reproduce like the adult. So for all I know, these mosquitoes were already adults, enjoying some warm winter weather and just became dormant and then reactivated when it got a little bit warmer over the weekend. Or they were in a pupal stage in the first place, and once the cold weather passed, they came out as adults. It could have been either one.
Tell me about roaches.
Well, the American cockroach, which is the one that we see in and around our homes most often, is in fact African in origin and came here accidentally, probably on ships, a couple hundred years ago. There's a very similar species. It's the same size, but it's all one color. It doesn't have that sort of two-toned top to its thorax, called the smoky brown roach. And I do not know what their difference in cold tolerance is. And we have other roaches, by the way, but most of them are not household pests. So those two big ones that we tend to see a lot, my suspicion is that they would be in the crevices of the bark of trees or underneath leaf litter. And here again, once the snow falls, they are in fact insulated from the coldest of the air. Now, I saw pictures that looked like dead roaches that some people sent me during and after our little snowmageddon there. And whether those roaches were truly dead or might have had the snow thaw and the water get off of them and literally started crawling away, you know, just hours after all of that as they warmed up, I don't know. Now, I can tell you that any of your listeners could probably Google American cockroach freezing, and with those three words, probably find a lot of information about the exact cold tolerance of that species. But I do not know it off the top of my head.
Did you know the only natural predator, the only thing, the apex predator, a cockroach, is a Doc Martin? Did you know that?
Yeah. it's very specific that out of all the predatory shoes in the world, only the Doc Martin.
The Doc Martin. That's the only thing that a cockroach is afraid of. But seriously, let's say, for example, and I want to ask you this, Zach, if cockroaches were to, because you know, an ecosystem is a delicate balance, right? I'll never forget when I learned that in school, how it really did stick with me, that lesson, how you better not touch with this, because if you fool that, it fools with this, and then that changes that. If cockroaches were to disappear tomorrow, would that be a good thing or a bad thing for the ecosystem as a whole? Do cockroaches do anything good for anybody ever?
Yes, they do. Let me start by saying that I don't want roaches in my house any more than the next person does. But there are about 4,000 species of roaches in the world, and only 12 or so are adaptable enough to get into buildings and eat the kind of stuff that humans leave behind, leave out, or create on purpose or by accident, right? So this is a very good case of a few rotten apples spoiling the barrel. Most of the world's roaches are detritivores. They eat decaying plant matter. And so when wood falls to the ground, when leaves fall to the ground and those things are dead, there are nutrients trapped in there. And any insect that starts to chew on that stuff and ultimately, you know, produces waste from it is releasing nitrogen, phosphorus, other compounds that are vital to healthy soil and plant growth. So if you don't have roaches and other decomposers, detritivores, in the environment, whether it's fields or forests or swamps, you lose a lot of the ability for nature to do what it's supposed to do, which is to move energy around. And in this case, it's the recycling of nutrients. Healthy soil is something that insects create a lot of, and we take it for granted, but we get our food and our oxygen from the plants that grow out of healthy soil. So aside from the fact that there are a lot of predators that rely on roaches up the food chain, including, you know, animals that we like to see even more than we like to see bugs, they actually do serve a purpose. And, Tommy, I get this question all the time. You know, what's the purpose of a flea? Why did nature make a mosquito? What's the point of roaches? And there's always numerically something significant. The biomass that insects make up, the sheer weight means they're going to exert some influence on the environment. And whether that is being food for other things or helping the ecosystem in a larger sense and coincidentally benefiting our species, it's something to keep in mind. One more thing, if I may.
I'll allow you some latitude, but watch yourself.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. The question about pest insects is always centered around humans. And I don't think the mice sit in their den at night and have these discussions. Oh, why are there hawks? What's the purpose of a snake? Come on, really? I mean, we got a life to live here. So
that's an interesting perspective. It's true. We're so egocentric. We always look at it as, for example, mosquitoes. Tell me what purpose mosquitoes serve.
That was going to be the end of my little rant there.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If an ecosystem is meant to keep all species in balance, mm-hmm. it may be that as animals that can spread diseases that kill humans, the purpose of mosquitoes is to keep the human population in check. I'm not saying that from an anthropocentric, from a self-interested standpoint, I want mosquitoes to kill humans. Of course I don't. But that may be why they're here. Now, you could then take your cockroach question and say, well, what if all the mosquitoes disappeared? Wouldn't that be better? It might be better for us in the disease vector viewpoint, but mosquitoes are food for lots of other things. Some mosquitoes are pollinators of plants. Now, on balance, what does that mean for us? That's a longer discussion. But I would not wave a wand if I had one and make all the mosquitoes on Earth disappear, because I think it would be unwise.
I'm not trying to engage in or wax philosophic here, but when it comes to the world, and just from the ecosystem standpoint, you could make an argument that if the planet is being destroyed by human beings, that would just be the ecosystem playing out, right? Where we got to the point, we evolved to the point where we could destroy ourselves?
There are a lot of people who believe that that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And we're an interesting species in that we have the ability now, at least, in our evolutionary history, to destroy the planet. We can do it now. I don't think that we had the technology or the numbers of our species on this planet to do it however many years ago you want to go back. Let's just say before 1800 would probably be a decent benchmark, I think. So, yeah, it's unfortunate that there's not a little bit more attention paid by us on a daily basis, myself included, to what we do and how it affects the health of the planet. There's certainly more concrete and asphalt and buildings and pollutants than I think any of us would want. But we've gotten to a stage where here we are. Now that's a far piece from what we started with. Happens when it freezes in New Orleans?
No, but
the answer is the insects do okay.
That always philosophically kind of triggered my mind, where it's like, well, okay, it's not good, but we always look at it from our standpoint. Well, from your standpoint, you're destroying your habitat. Let's talk about geckos, if we can, real quick. I don't know if that's in your wheelhouse or not, but geckos used to freak me out, but now I just let them hang out in the house because I believe they serve a purpose as well. Do they not? Can they hurt me? Can a gecko hurt me being in the house?
A gecko cannot hurt you being in the house. Both of the species of geckos that we have in New Orleans, and they look very similar, are introduced species. And we haven't really talked a lot about introduced species, but mm-hmm. by and large, you want an organism to stay in the place where nature put it originally. Mm-hmm. So when we move things around, we have disastrous consequences sometimes, like with kudzu and water hyacinth, to name a couple of plants that are problematic in our wetlands, mm-hmm. or apple snails, to name another problematic wetland species. But so the geckos that we have are nocturnal and they eat insects. Was there something else around, or is there something else around that does what they do, that they're out competing? That is out of my wheelhouse. I will tell you that our zoo reptile curator, Robert, is a terrific source of information about this, and I would encourage you to get him on, too, for gecko and all other herpetological questions. But I would say that any organism out of place shouldn't be where it is. So by way of example, if you don't know what tallow trees are, mm-hmm. and all you know is that none of our trees give us fall colors except this one. Oh, wait, this one. Oh, it gets pretty orange and yellow leaves. Well, that's all fine and good, and you may like it for that reason. But tallow does so many other bad things when you plop it down in South Louisiana that the bad outweighs the good. And so with the geckos, let's just say that our geckos eat lots and lots of mosquitoes. I don't know if they do or not. The point is they shouldn't be here. And I like them. I think geckos are fantastic little lizards, but, it's an animal out of place.
Well, I look at it akin to having a cat in a house to take care of mice.
Yeah. Some of our mice probably are introduced also. The cats, certainly. You know, domestication of cats is something that has spanned centuries and continents. So we may not be able to apply this introduced species thing as a blanket all over the place, because when we talk about domesticated animals, which we have in our homes or on farms for specific purposes, it's probably a different discussion. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk it real quick before I let you go. And I know you're not a the reptile guy, but when you talk about geckos, you're talking about they have the ones that are outside, right? That are the green and brown ones, and then there's those weird stripe looking ones that are inside, or that hang around the soffit and fascia eating mosquitoes.
Yeah, I think you have probably now in that last little question discussed two different types of lizards. So the anoles that are native to this area, the green anole, is a monochromatic lizard that can be all green or all brown. Brown, all green or all brown. And when the dewlap, that little skin flap under the throat comes out, it is solid pink.
Right.
The introduced anole that is physically just like it is always brown, and then it has a dorsal midline with a pattern. So basically, something right down the middle of its back is patterned with two different colors of brown and lots of different symmetrical little markings on it. And its dewlap is red and yellow. And that's called the brown anole. It used to be called the Cuban anole, and I think its name has changed.
And it's a lot faster, is it not?
I think so, yeah. I've certainly had trouble catching them. Yeah. And they're also more terrestrial. The other ones tend to be on plants a little bit more. The native ones tend to be better climbers. Now, the things that are up on around your light at night, those are geckos. And as I was saying earlier, we have two species of introduced geckos here, and they're built very differently. They have a fatter, shorter tail. They have wider, broader toes with special structures for climbing smooth surfaces, and a flatter, shorter nose, if you will. Their face isn't as long and narrow. So we've got two geckos and two lizards that are common in the middle of the city, only one of which is native to the area.
Very. So if you see these things in the house, should you kill them or should you just put them outside?
I usually put them outside.
Yeah.
You know, I do like them, and they are here to stay. And I don't think that, one or two people who don't like geckos getting rid of them is going to make much of a dent in their population. And to my knowledge, the geckos that we have not wreaked havoc on our local ecosystem.
I went from hating them and being afraid of them to it's like, you know what? Go ahead, little fellas, eat whatever you eat. I'll leave you alone. You leave me alone, we're fine. Thank you. This has been very entertaining. Zach, I hope you come back.
Have me again. I'd love to come back. Thanks, Tommy.
And be careful crossing Lake Tucker if you cross the causeway. Zach Lehman, curator of animal collections at the Audubon Insectarium. Yesterday, we talked about a new study about parents and actually having a favored child. We're going to get some tips on parenting and avoiding that from our good friend, Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Pardon me, when we come back on WWL. 9:30, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend, Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books, and mom of Luca. How you doing, Dr. Judy?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, I know you spent time in New Orleans at Tulane, and you would not believe what this area is like when we get 8 inches of snow.
Oh, wow. Well, yes, we don't get to experience that at all here. I gotta say, I miss those elements.
Yeah, well, we don't have it too often either, and let's hope we don't have it for a while because it was a mess. Let's talk about California and your area and the fires. What's the latest, Dr. Judy?
Well, you know, the efforts are continuing. Thank goodness we did have a rain yesterday. That was very helpful. But, you know, just the high winds, they just keep picking up. So every few days, there's a high fire risk, and we just had another one break out last week. So it's definitely touch and go here, but, you know, we're all doing our best and definitely bringing us closer together as a community, I will say.
So yesterday we had a conversation with a doctor about a study that they did about parents having favored children. And I know you only have one. I only have one. And it doesn't really resonate with me because I don't know what it would be like. But we had a conversation about how, like it or not, parents do have favorite children and the reasons behind that. And then we heard from some grown people who I was in the middle, and I was the youngest, and I know my parents had a favorite that was my older brother, but that doesn't, I don't carry any grudges or anything like that. Let's talk about it from the grown-up standpoint, if they feel as though they were slighted as a child, and then we'll get to the parenting part of it. Is it common for people to carry this forward if they feel as though their parents had a favorite and somehow that manifests itself in anger or resentment or something?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that those are the pros and cons of having siblings. You know, you get to have this amazing support system. You get to grow up with people, play with them, enjoy these experiences. But also, inherently, for many families, there's a feeling of competition of who is the favorite, what your relationship is like. And, you know, I don't think as parents you can really help that because, you know, we're all people. We have different dynamics and different relationships and different degrees of closeness and how you like to spend time. And that differs with each child because every child has a different personality. And it's a bi-directional process of your personality as a parent interacting with the personality types of your children.
I would ask the audience here at the Elkhornart Jeweler Talk and Text Line 504-260-1870, continuing the conversation from about this time yesterday. Did you have a favorite child or do you have a favorite child? I'm not going to give you a number or anything like that. This is your chance to fess up and be honest. If you do you have a favorite child or not? And even though trying to treat them all equally, or if you're a grown-up now and your parents had a favorite, does it bug you? Again, I mentioned my older brother was a favorite. It doesn't matter, just the way it plays out, right? So when it comes to, Dr. Judy, human nature and parents, some people like others more than the other people, right? I mean, that just is part of being human?
I do think that it is part of being human. And I think that it is hard when you know, of course, it feels very personal if you're the child on the receiving end. But for some of us, and for maybe many of your listeners, they're in what we call a bit of that sandwich generation where, of course, you know, you're taking care of your parents and then at the same time, you're also taking care of your children. And I think that when people become parents, maybe they start to realize a little bit of that feeling that maybe they were stressed out about with their parents, that maybe there are different dynamics in the family, especially if you are a parent to more than one child. But even when I look at my relationship with Luca and my husband's relationship with Luca, it's very different as well, you know, and my husband has said, oh, well, Luca just wants to be with you. Well, of course, I mean, he's 3 years old and I'm his mom, and there's a certain kind of comfort that a three-year-old wants from his mom. But he likes to spend time in a different way with his dad, right? So the relationship quality is always going to be different from person to person. And it's not necessarily that there's a favorite, more so that it's just different. And maybe part of it is letting go of any of that kind of resentment toward your parents and just recognizing that there are these different dynamics. That doesn't mean that they love you any less just because they like to spend time with your sibling in a certain way or even in more time than you.
Did you hear that can just open? Because you just opened a giant can of questions, and that goes to children sometimes favoring a parent, because it can go the other way, as well as parents having favored children. Of course, with children, you probably just got two parents, although there can be some step-parents involved. So what would you say to parents? Is it normal for, or is it even believable to think that the child is going to love or be want to spend time with both mom and dad equally at any one given point in life?
No, I mean, I think that when I look at everybody around me, when I talk to my friends, see my own family members, talk with my patients, I mean, it's so rare to have it feel extremely and exactly equal. And I don't know if there's a time in development where it definitely feels that way. I think that it just changes across development and your relationship and who you go to and what you talk about and how you like to spend time changes over time too with each parent. But I do think that, you know, children probably develop their go-to person for certain things. That doesn't mean that they favor them, but it's just like, you know, they go to mom for this type of advice, or they go to dad for hugs, or they go to mom because mom is, you know, more active in helping them with their homework, or, you know, every single family's dynamic is different, and a child will look like they're favoring that parent, in a certain developmental phase or with certain activities, but that's just because they see eye to eye with that parent. You know, another example is when a parent and a child share a hobby. I have friends who, you know, for example, their parents got them into a certain sport. And it's because that parent played that sport when they were younger. And so naturally, they're going to go to that parent to talk about that sport and how they're doing.
Do daughters necessarily gravitate to mothers or to fathers, or boys to mothers or fathers, or is it all completely independent, each case?
I think it can be independent, but I think that there is a stereotype out there that, like, you know, girls are daddy's girls, and, like, you know, moms are mom, like, boys are mama's boys. I mean, I think that maybe there's a bit of a slight trend, but only because I think the cultural stereotype exists. It's almost like when you know that stereotype exists and you kind of live to produce that. So I'm not even sure. It's like a chicken or the egg syndrome. Like, I feel like maybe there is a slight trend, but I feel like some of that is also just your expectations of what that relationship should be like.
Somebody texted in and said, my daughter always favored my husband because he was the fun parent. I had to be the disciplinarian. I know that happens a lot. What would you say to parents? Tell you what, Dr. Judy, let me take a break because we're a little bit late here. We'll take a break and then we'll talk about it when we come back on the other side, because, boy, there's a lot of different elements at play here. Both, you know, you get the parents that don't want to be hurt by their kids. They love the kids. They want to feel as though the kids love them both equally. Then you got, you know, with the parents competing against each other for the kids' attention. Then when you got more than one kid, it gets even more complicated than that, which I guess is good, because then different kids can have different parents. A lot going on here. 938, you got any questions or comments? 504-260-1870. Time now for traffic on WWL. It is 9:44, 16 till 10, talking to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, following up on a conversation that we had yesterday about parents having favorite children. And Dr. Judy brought up, I don't know, advertently or inadvertently, about, I don't even know if advertently is a word, not the point, but that sometimes children can have favored parents and can look at the parents differently, and that opens up a completely different dynamic. And we struck a nerve, Dr. Judy, because the text line's going crazy here with people saying that I was the good cop, my husband was the bad cop, my husband was a good cop, the kids gravitated toward him. How do you balance all of that out with parenting duties? And I think in my case, my kid kind of hung out with me because I was the fun guy, right? But I don't think my child loved her mother any, or my ex-wife any less. I just think it was, take me through that whole dynamic here.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's interesting, because I think we definitely, one, bring out different things with our children based on our own upbringing. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's certain things we really loved about our childhood that we're trying to replicate, or maybe there are things that we definitely don't want to replicate. And so you become essentially maybe a very different parent than the parent or parents you were exposed to. And I also think that sometimes when you look at the other parent, if you are in a two-parent household, or even if you're not and you're co-parenting, and you're trying to provide a balance to what that other person is doing. So, like, for example, if you see that your other partner is being, in your opinion, a bit harsh, you're going to balance that by being more nurturing, or, you know, being the more playful parent. And I think that that causes a lot of distress among the parents, like, oh my gosh, why aren't you on my side? But I think it's also that you're looking at your child and you're saying, well, they need this other thing, because right now they're getting too much of one thing, right? And so that, of course, is going to cause certain differences, not only in parenting, but also children's response, right? So over time, children obviously respond very quickly to patterns. And if they see that one parent is generally the one that is stricter, and the other parent is the one who's saying, hey, lay off them, don't worry about it, then they're going to go to that more lax parent for certain things. But I would also say that every single type of parenting, in terms of whether or not you're the strict one or the playful one, it serves a role. And children need boundaries, and they actually like boundaries. They feel protected by boundaries, even if they protest against it. So I would say that it's important to look at your other parenting partner with compassion as well through this whole process, And also try not to be so jealous if you think that your child is going to them more for one thing or another, because everything serves a role.
And not to insult anybody's children, because we were all kids, but it's not uncommon for kids to play parents against each other either, right?
Oh, my gosh. That is one of the things that they love doing. And again, when you get, don't be insulted by that, because that is healthy development. It's testing limits, making sure that, you know, they can't pull a fast one on you. If they do, they feel kind of like they've outsmarted you. But then once you confront them again, they're like, oop, got put in my place. You know, that's a very normal and generally healthy dynamic if it doesn't go completely to the wayside. You have to expect that they're going to challenge you, even if they love you and adore you. You know, even Luca at 3 years old, you know, he's already said to my husband or me, you know, vice versa, like, hey, mama said I could have this toy. Nope, nobody said that. But, you know, he's just hoping that maybe one of us didn't check with the other. And that happens from a very young age. And that doesn't mean that they don't respect or love you. It's just because, you know, they're trying to grow up. They're trying to figure out what they can do and what they can't.
I can remember my kid being 3 years old, being in the corner after mom sent the kid there. And if I had not negotiated a settlement, I think that kid'd still be in that corner. And that was 25 years ago.
I'm not kidding.
If I had not negotiated that settlement. So sometimes, I guess the first thing is parents need to be on the same page and they need to not undercut each other. Accurate?
Yeah, definitely. Try to do that as much as you can is, you know, consult the other parent. Don't speak badly about the other parent, whether you're still with that partner or not, because kids really pick up on that and they carry that distress with them from a very young age. So if you have any personal squabbles about your parenting, work it out in private, but not in front of your child.
So somebody texted in, and Dr. Judy, I know you are a licensed clinical neuropsychologist. You're 3 years into being a mom. How do you balance who's the disciplinarian and who's the, I guess, the management strategy? I always looked at it as though you're managing an employee, because that's kind of what you're doing, right? But with love, how do you as parents get together, have the same strategy? I would suggest maybe there are some things to learn that you do have a set of rules and you follow them and you never maybe contradict the other in front of the kid. Take me through all of this.
Yeah. So, I mean, your roles and your rules are going to shift as they get older too. So I think that you can have some general rules of thumb, but also it will need to be renegotiated from time to time. And you're not going to be able to anticipate all the times you're going to have to renegotiate until something happens. And so I think expecting that is important, that, you know, sometimes there's going to be twists and turns that you don't anticipate, and that's fine as long as you have an agreed upon way to discuss any differences in parenting when a new challenge comes up, because it could just be staring you in the face. And in the moment, you might be doing something different than what your partner or the co-parent is doing. And the idea is that in the moment, you may be stressed out about it and frustrated that they're responding in that way. But remember that there's no way either of you probably could have anticipated this particular issue. So just make a plan that when things come up like that, like, how will you talk about them? How will you signal to the other parent that you want to have a discussion? And always make sure that that discussion is away from the child. Sometimes parents are negotiating in front of their child, you know, like, well, why would you say that? I don't agree with that. No, I think they should get to do this. I mean, children are picking up on all of that. Not only does it make them feel stressed, but also they're watching for times when they can play you against each other. So I think to not bring them into this, that conversation should always happen privately at a separate time. And if one parenting decision wasn't aligned, it's fine. It's okay that parenting decision in the moment, because it wasn't negotiated ahead of time, was a little bit skewed. It's okay as long as you come back to the table, negotiate what makes sense, and then the next time, be on the same page.
This conversation could probably go on for 20 more hours, but in a couple of minutes that we have left, somebody texted in about step-parents, and I think about that movie Moneyball. There's the awkward scene where Brad Pitt's with the teenage daughter talking to the mother and the stepfather about the cell phone and who decides on who gets what. How do you determine a role or fit a role for the step-parent into this, or does the step-parent have a voice?
Yeah, I do think that the step-parent can have a voice, but I think that that should be, again, negotiated ahead of time with the co-parent and also be somewhat gradual in that maybe the step-parent, as they're just becoming integrated into that child's life, is not responsible for discipline, is not responsible for laying down the rules. Rather, they should just be aligning with whatever rules you and the other co-parent has already set in place, but they shouldn't really be the primary disciplinarian. That I don't think that is the right role. If the step-parent is in the life of the child for a longer period of time, then gradually they could probably have a say in terms of how they'd like to help raise the child. But always remember that you are one of three or one of four parents in this particular picture. And so it's going to be a negotiation. And also the person, if they have both of their biological parents in the picture, you also have to sometimes defer to that just because of the politics involved and because they are the biological parents. So I think the step-parent should never be afraid to actively parent, but just remember that there's a bit of a negotiation process. Sometimes it's a bit of a pecking order depending on the household, and also to introduce your more active roles gradually. And think about yourself as more of a support parent rather than the primary decider for a while.
So somebody texted in, should stepdad and dad's vote count equally? Mine's 28. I'll never have another one, so I don't really have a horse in this race, but I would say no. Stepdad's presuming that everybody's, you know, contributing to society and healthy and happy and all that stuff. I don't see where stepdad's vote would be equal to dad's. Thoughts?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that that would be the case unless it's a situation where the biological dad is just not super involved at all. And that does happen in certain families where then the stepfather is saying, hey, I'm with your daughter almost 24/7. You don't know where you are most of the time. And then all of a sudden you come in after a month of not being in contact and then you want to have the say in everything. I think that in cases like that, and unfortunately they do happen sometimes, then it might be that the step-parent actually has more of a voice because they're actually the one that's there more often. So I think that it's just different for each family in that way, and just really consider what the circumstances are. But sometimes I think the step-parent can have a louder voice.
Yeah, if mom and dad, or either mom or dad, are doing a stretch in Angola, you know, you got to look at it differently. Somebody texted in about how to handle parent alienating children against other parent after a divorce. Maybe we can talk about that next time, because that sounds like a two-hour conversation to me. Thank you, Dr. Judy. Appreciate it as always. Tell Luca hi.
Thanks, Tom.
You bet. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical licensed neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Quick break, then we'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today here on WWL.